When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
This is Talk of the Devils, the Athletics podcast dedicated to Manchester United. We're back to react to Burnley, to look ahead to what might be for Manchester United next season as well, and to chat about anything else that comes up randomly over the course of the next 40 minutes or so. So I need to say good morning to Andy Mitten and Carl Anker. You all right, gents?
Morning, morning.
Hello, Ian.
Carl, you enjoyed your trip to Old Trafford, did you, on Saturday?
The sun was shining, and when the sun is shining in Manchester, that's always a bonus.
Yeah, that's a bit of avoidance there to talk about the real topic at hand. Andy, did you enjoy that Saturday?
I wouldn't say enjoy. I was enjoying it until Andre Onana decided they would go on a little adventure. I could see merit in a lot of what Manchester United were trying to do. Lots of negatives as well. But I did enjoy it. This isn't the end of Mourinho or Van Gaal for me, where I was just bored into submission. I am actually going, you are sat on the edge of your seat going, there's been 40 attempts. It's a shame that 20 of them were for Burnley.
Yeah.
And it baffled me. Burnley were going to have more possession than Manchester United. You knew that was coming before the game, and it happened. And that is really worrying.
Yeah, it is. But you are watching one of the most entertaining and dynamic teams in the Premier League, aren't you? Which we'll talk about later on after Erik ten Hag made that claim following full time. But before we get into it, let's get the final voice note from Vietnam. From Laurie Whitwell.
Hello guys, it's my fourth and final voice note from Vietnam, and if you can hear waves crashing in the background, that's because I'm on Cat Bar, which is a beautiful island in the Ha Long Bay area of the country, which is a region that people come to from all over because of the incredible limestone rocks that jut out of the ocean like something out of Jurassic Park, which is apt because they were formed 340 million years ago in the Carboniferous period, which I'm sure Andy knows all about. But I'll go away from my balcony on my hotel. I just thought I'd start the voice note there and come somewhere quieter into the hotel room. That was my Michael Palin impression, Ian. I hope that was as good as the last one. Thank you, Carl, for making him give me a bit of credit for getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning for the Sheffield United game. The Burnley game was a lot earlier, at 9 o'clock in the evening, so we just went there as a family after our meal. Went to a bar in Cat Bar Town called Oasis, a bit of a Manchester flick there, I suppose. And it's a lot busier than we'd anticipated because it's actually Vietnamese holidays this weekend, so families flock from all over to come to Cat Bar and enjoy themselves. It's got a little bit of a feel of a Blackpool sort of seaside resort, if you get my vibe, but it means that it's a very enjoyable place to sort of walk around and just see the bright lights. So the bar that we watched it in started off quite sedate, actually, and then as the game wore on, a DJ started, a smoke machine started, and by the end of it, it was very rammed, and it probably wasn't an appropriate place for a small baby to be. So we made our exit swiftly at full time. He was asleep, he'd had enough anyway. And I actually enjoyed the game, and I don't know if that was a result of me having one of the cocktails on offer, which came fun bucket sized, but I just thought that United actually played a bit more sort of positively, certainly at the start, and could have been ahead. And I know that obviously that then means that Burnley, or doesn't mean, but it sort of allowed Burnley to have chances and could have easily been 2-2, 3-3, couldn't it? Onana pulled off some good saves. But I don't know, I kind of prefer United playing that way than at times in the past where we've seen them not create chances. And I know that's what Erik ten Hag spoke about afterwards, and clearly you want a balance between being able to actually create chances and have control of the game. So that's the next step. I don't know how much of a leniency you give to the injuries that they've had out. I think Casemiro as a centre-back, yeah, it's obviously needs must, isn't it? But it's far, far from ideal because there were moments where Burnley were able to exploit that. And even when Casemiro stepped into midfield, you had moments when, you know, Sander Berg, for example, sort of just walked past him. And it has been a really troubling sort of period, this for Casemiro in terms of his drop-off. So, yeah, we'll see if he can... You know, at least he's fit, so that's something. If you can kind of sustain that for the rest of the season, yeah. I mean, it was obviously quite close to being a sort of decent-ish victory. I mean, they should be beating Burnley, shouldn't they? 1-1 at home isn't good enough against a team that's probably going to go down. And clearly, at the end, Onana's exuberance that he got away with against Wolves at the start of the season didn't do so here because of VAR. You can obviously understand why they called it back. I don't know. I still have a slight issue with that being called back and not any of the ones that United were appealing for. I feel like Garnacho certainly could have had a penalty. You know, the handball from Antony's flick, you don't really want to see them given, but then again, United have had that given against them. So you sort of think on the balance of probabilities, maybe they could have got one, but you don't really want to have to be relying on officiating to get the result. So yeah, I mean, it's another bad result, isn't it? In the kind of the abacus of Erik ten Hag's season, but I kind of feel like given the circumstances, you know, you accept now that Champions League is obviously beyond hope. I suppose they do need to qualify for Europe in some form, and that kind of result doesn't help at all. So yeah, on to the next one. But next time I join you on the podcast, maybe I'll be in the UK. But yeah, it's been a real pleasure listening to you guys from afar, getting some really good topics. So yeah, speak to you soon, and I'll see you when I'm back.
Yeah, thank you, Laurie. It's become a bit of a minor tradition that on the podcast in recent weeks, but it's over now and Laurie will be back in the UK, like he says, very soon. He sort of set out a few talking points for us there quite nicely. So thank you again for that, Laurie. Andy, first of all, you were nodding along to quite a lot of that in terms of the style that Manchester United were trying to play with against Burnley. Do you agree with the sort of opinion that it's better for United to try and do this than what we maybe had in the early parts of the season?
Yeah, and as I said in the first part, this isn't endgame Van Gaal or Mourinho. It is entertaining, but you're almost going against the grain by saying that because it was a really disappointing result. And Burnley are 19th. I do think that Burnley do deserve some praise. That they've lost one game in eight. I think if that group of players goes down, they will come straight back up. Equally, I can't believe that I'm saying this because Manchester United should be putting Burnley out of sight at Old Trafford. And they had a lot of chances as well.
Mm-hmm. 16 shots.
Yeah, I could see merit in what Manchester United were trying to do. But it just comes under the bigger picture because the mood's pretty low. And Manchester United in the last week have played Sheffield United, Coventry City, three teams who are almost certainly going to be in the Championship next season. And they look pretty uncomfortable at various stages in the game.
Yep.
To all three of them. And it should be better.
Yeah, absolutely. Carl, your match verdict starts with the line, Manchester United have failed to win five of their past six Premier League games. And that sort of flies against any notion that Saturday was good, really, I suppose.
The first half, I described it as decent enough. And I had quite a few boos and jeers saying, if you think that's decent enough, then things are really bad. I went, no, I thought United were in control for the majority of proceedings in the first half. I also said it was decent enough, but also Onana still had to make two or three saves to keep Burnley out of it. And that's the weird thing about United, is even when they are having a better performance than they have done this season, they're still liable to letting the opponent in. You know, Burnley had the shot within 18 seconds on Saturday. Fofana just ran in behind and got a flick on, and Onana had to make a save. And I'd say, while Murek was the busier of the two goalkeepers, Onana had to make the more showbiz. Oh, thank goodness for that. Otherwise, that was going in.
I think one in the first half was probably the best save he's made for Manchester United from Odegaard's header. I think it was. The reaction save was fantastic.
One from Odegaard's header, one from Lafosta's header, and you're going, okay, this is it. I think I said, if we had this Onana at the start of the season, maybe Manchester United have been... reach the Champions League knockout stages, you never know. But it's one of them. Again, you know, it's another game where you're wishing your wingers had their shooting boots on. Garnacho probably could have finished that first half and probably is kicking himself that he didn't finish that first half with a goal. And one thing that was really, really concerning, or
Sorry.
It wasn't concerning because I know this happens. We all know Christian Eriksen tires in the second half of games, and it gets to the hour mark, and the game is getting a bit stretched in midfield, and I think quite a few fans at Old Trafford going, make a sub, Eric, make a sub. The double switch does come on. It's Højlund and Maine who comes off, and Eriksen stays on, and that was booze. You know, this isn't the first time this season that Ten Hag's been booed for taking off Rasmus Højlund. But that reaction, that sort of, it was a very mixed reaction. It was booze once you realise Maynard's coming off, and then cheers as he approached the dugout as a Maynard, we're still with you.
Yeah.
Ahmad came on and McTominay came on, and then McTominay had to go off again with what looks like a quite concerning knee issue. And I think now you're hearing more visible dissent from the Old Trafford fan base because there's less and less faith that Ten Hag knows what he's doing, in air quotes, you know, knows the best way to turn draws into wins and wins into keep winning at the end of full time.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And obviously I've read your article and, you know, the takeaway from it is that, oh, do you remember once upon a time, fans booing at Old Trafford was almost unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can you remember them going through absolute disasters and crises and behind at half time, losing games, no matter what, no one booed. You know, it's like a badge of honour. We don't boo. I mean, Saturday you had sort of grumbles maybe at half time is probably the right way to put it. Boos at full time, grumbles when Højlund's number was held up, then definitely audible boos, loud ones when Maynard's number was held up. I mean, Andy, it's not great, is it? But you can understand fans' frustration. I mean, how did you read that substitution? Ten Hag's defended it. We'll go into that in a moment. But, you know, how did you read the entire thing, the reaction to it and the decision in the first place?
There's a lot of frustration about maybe fans were proud of not booing, but I can certainly remember the Stretford End singing, Fergie, sort them out, just before half-time.
Yeah.
But that at least showed that there was faith in the manager to sort them out.
To sort them out, yeah.
And true, yeah. I think now that the fan base is pretty split on Erik ten Hag, I think there's a lot of fans feeling conflicted about what they want next. Do you change the manager? Lots of really reasonable opinions. Well, it's not just about the manager. Look who's come before this manager. It's about the structure. It's about the players. It's about the manager. And I think you can argue, and we have done pretty strongly, his stock's definitely come down. You heard the concern from a lot of fans about the substitutions. I think there's been pretty general criticism of Erik ten Hag's substitutions, not just yeah, this weekend. He tends to go with the similar sort of players. And fans, they're pretty desperate because there's a push for a player to get more minutes because he deserves it, because they hope that player... It was Palestra at the start of the season.
It was.
And when he got more minutes, he wasn't actually the world beater that some fans hoped that he would be. And then it was Garnacho and Ahmad. And you could strongly argue that Ahmad does deserve more minutes.
There was a very pronounced moment late in the second half where Ahmad, he tracked back, I want to say, 10, 20 yards.
Yeah.
Won the ball back, played the ball, set up a Fernandez cross, and it got, you know, two or three people in front of me stood up from their seats and were applauding him.
Yeah.
And he is definitely the player United fans want to see more of at this point in time. But also, you're putting a lot of responsibility on a relatively young Manchester United player, and I mean that in terms of how many appearances he's had. And I think the things Ahmad is best at aren't necessarily the things Ten Hag wants the first team to do right now, which means there's this tension.
I think as well, you know, when I watched that game, I didn't think that Maynard and Højlund from the 90 minutes or from the 60 minutes, 65 minutes, whatever it was that I'd been watching, I didn't think they should have been the ones to be removed for those changes. When I saw McTominay was coming on, instantly I thought it was Christian Eriksen who was coming off.
Mm-hmm.
When I saw Ahmad was coming on, instantly I thought it was one of the wide players who was going to come off. I mean, Garnacho was limping a little bit when he saw that it was Ahmad stood up at the side of the pitch coming on. I actually saw him come over to Ten Hag, say, is it me? I'm fine. My ankle, my foot, whatever's hurting, there's no issue with me. Don't take me off again. I'm okay. And he was sort of reassured, no, it's not you, which was a bit bizarre, but fine. I guess that was his way of saying, you know, just to make sure there's no issue at all in thinking that he did have a problem and he needed to come off. You can say what you want then about, you know, whether Ten Hag would have took him off anyway if that was his decision. But that was the issue, I think. And like you said, Andy, as well, it fed into the narrative of recent weeks that people aren't sure about the changes that he's making in game, and it added to that, didn't it? But Ten Hag said, it's not just about what's happening on the pitch in those moments. I have to manage the workload for these lads. These are young players in their first year in the Premier League. Maynou's had, obviously, his issue at the start of the season. He had issues with injury last season. Hoyland's had minor issues, probably because of workload, as this season's gone on as well. So he has to have that in mind too. He said that the crowd don't understand, which I presume means they don't know exactly how tired or how impacted these players are by the amount of minutes they've had to play in recent weeks.
He's privy to far more information. And when I was inside Carrington, there's a lot of information that the managers and the coaches can get. What the fans do understand is that Manchester United simply cannot hold on to a lead. And that is a massive concern, not even just against the best teams, but teams like Burnley. And much as the crowd are cheering and mad for running back after 69 minutes to block yet another Burnley counter-attack, he wasn't brought to do that. And they're all over the shop. And it always leads back into questions about the manager and the defensive side of the game. And yet, I find myself talking in contradictions. I thought Harry Maguire and Onana were probably Manchester United's best two players. Onana's certainly up to that mistake. So you've got a central defender there and you've got a goalkeeper. And yet a criticism of Ten Hag's game is that I don't think he ever, when he was at Ajax, had to really focus on the defensive side like he's needing to in the Premier League, because the team's conceding too many goals, because they're giving up too many chances. And it's just a worry. And we've gone on this pod to saying top four and a trophy, just to slowly dripping down and down and down. And I know we'll talk further on in this podcast about Europa League, might even be the Europa Conference League. It's been a really complex club this year with all the off-field stuff, but even with the on-field stuff as well.
Yeah.
Because we don't really know where we're going with the manager. And is anyone absolutely stunned that Burnley got a draw at Old Trafford? We're just not, are we? Are you?
We should be.
We should be.
We should be.
Well, that's a different argument, isn't it? We should be, but yeah.
We have this every now and again this season where we have a run of quote-unquote winnable games. And they used to be winnable games. Last season, they were winnable games. And I remember turn of the new year, Andy, you said some of these fixtures, including Luton away, these are winnable. We can build some momentum and boom, boom, boom. And I do remember before Coventry, before Burnley, before Sheffield United, one of us went, these are games that should be winnable, but I'm not sure anymore. I think this is the concern now, where there is a creeping doubt and sadness about everything United do. Nothing is guaranteed about Manchester United in the way it should be. I get the tram to Old Trafford for home games, bumped into a fan who sort of spotted me and said, love the pod, whatnot. And I said, what's your prediction for today? And he said, 2-0. And my response was, really? You think United will keep a clean sheet? Because my brain now doesn't think United can keep clean sheets anymore. Which is remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know,
this
is a football. This is a football team. This is, you know, fifth richest football club in the world, one of the most, the third most expensively assembled squad in world football, more than 200 million spent on centre backs. And yes, obviously, big flashing neon night injuries.
Yeah, nearly 30 different back four combinations, yeah, probably lead into that mistrust of keeping clean sheets.
I can't remember the last time I went to a Manchester United game and went, United are keeping a clean sheet today. That's one, just a huge injury crisis and just what that has done to everything, but also Ten Hag's response to an injury crisis. There's that phrase of no plan survives first contact with the enemy. Ten Hag's plan B and plan C and plan D have been confusing. And when I spend, you know, it's our job on this podcast, it's our job as journalists to try and figure out why he's going about this. And I now understand why he wants to go about this. But I do also can't shake that doubt of, is this truly the best way to use what remaining players you have left to go about things?
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
It is this him, Carl? Is this Ten Hag's football? Is this the way he wants to play? Because it seems a huge contradiction to last season even, let alone his body of work before that. And I understand different clubs, different players demand different styles. But managers usually have that core principle to the way that they play. He's about control, isn't he?
No. Let me...
More than this, so, though, what, surely.
One of the big things of his time at Ajax was last line occupation. So he would flood forward the final line of defence with multiple players. So both fullbacks would get forward. You'd have one of your number eight get ahead. Your number 10 would get ahead. And your striker would be there. So for a lot of your attacks, there were four or five players on the last line of attack, and you'd have some very clever midfield players trying to stretch the play. And also those players on the last line of opposition defence were interchanging. This is why Donny van de Beek was so good, because he was running from the 10 across from the 9 into the right half space. Mazraoui, your right back, could also attack the inside spaces. Hakim Ziyech and your other fullbacks could switch and do whatever. Frankie de Jong, when he was there, he'd be in the final third. And when it wasn't Frankie de Jong, it was Ryan Gravenberch. So it was having loads of very, very intelligent players being able to interpret space and interchanging on that last line. So the control, I suppose, is Ten Hag eventually wants a team to be a pick-your-poison scenario where defence is going, there are so many different options that are trying to score against us. We don't know what we're doing, so we're just going to have to sit back and, you know, you're trying to avoid one punch, but you don't realise another punch is trying to get you the other way. And I think Ten Hag wanted to do that this season. So it would have been Casemiro as your anchor, Mason Mount in your final third, Diogo Dalot in the final third, Luke Shaw in your final third, Anthony in the final third, Rashford in your final third, Højlund in your final third. The problem with that is the teams in the Premier League are just so much better at pushing you back. And you saw that with Wolves, right? Where Mason Mount pushed forward and Wolves went, okay, well, we're just going to get Cunha to run through the space. Yeah. Or against Tottenham Hotspur, where United tried doing that and Postecoglou at halftime went, all right, make the centre-back stand further apart. Or again against Brighton. I think a lot of Ten Hag's disappointing performances as a United manager have been a result of him not understanding the opposite man is as intelligent as he is and not responding to the adaptations the opposite manager is doing in time. Vincent Kompany's press conference after the game was really interesting because he said, I'm a Burnley manager. He goes, style of play isn't that important right now. What's really important when you're in a relegation battle is legs and just going at these players. And he said one big thing for Burnley was we cannot play with fear. We're 19th. If we play with fear, if we don't make the pass, we're done. We're dusted. We're relegated. So our thing now is just run at them repeatedly and be ambitious with your passing and try and get in those areas of the box. I think Ten Hag underestimated that in the second half. I don't think he was ready for how quick Burnley were going to come out the blocks. I don't think he was ready for the fact that Burnley weren't going to give up after going 1-0 down. And his response to that, Ten Hag, was lacking.
You can't be having less possession against Burnley at Old Trafford. United need to keep the ball better, need to dominate the game more. Thought the team started really well in the first 20 minutes, although Burnley had the first chance, and getting the ball back. Is that on the manager or is that on the players? He's giving them specific instructions what to do, and then they're not doing it. In terms of the opponents, Ten Hag talks up the strength of the league all the time, and I think he's right there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an uncomfortable truth because you just assume that Manchester United are going to get back to being great at whatever cost. There are some really, really strong teams there. And if teams don't get it right, like Chelsea with the recruitment, you can fall away very quickly. People thought Newcastle United would be much stronger this year. They've spent a lot less than Manchester United have. Throwing the injuries, that's just convoluted everything that we've got with Manchester United. It's a very fractured squad. It's such a mixed squad. Mm. It's built by four or five different managers. There's issues all over the place. You can see that morale is not as high as it should be. And that runs for fans as well. There's frustrations between players and fans and vice versa. You had issues over the tickets. When you're seeing rivals, you know, Manchester City are going to win the league, they're going to win it this year, they're going to win it next year, they're going to win it the year after. When Ten Hag talks about not being able to win the league next year, on one hand, I'm thinking, he's right. I believe him. Mm. We can see this. But in the other, sport is supposed to make us dream. We're supposed to think, you know, did Leicester's manager say we're not going to win the league in 2015? You're always hoping for a brighter future. And all the messages you're getting from people like Jim Ratcliffe is, yeah, that brighter future will come, but be patient. This is going to take a long time. and especially so with the financial fair play. It's not like in 89 when Fergie had been there for 3 years and he was really up against it. The club went out and splashed the cash big time. But even then, it took another couple of years to filter through to success. Probably going to be even longer with Manchester United. We keep hearing about the resets. Get rid of the deadwood. This is the fourth or fifth time we've heard this now post-Fergie. And that just adds into all the frustration.
Well, Andy said the strength of the league. I think another thing, Ten Hag did not plan for Premier League teams to literally be this strong, physically strong. Like, there are just a number of players in that starting lineup that don't have the physical capability to win as many 1v1 battles in the way that, you know, Ajax's best player wins as many 1v1 battles against the Eredivisie players, because Ajax are just so much more, so much financially stronger than everyone else. And I think that's taken him by surprise too, right? There's been multiple games since the turn of the year where United players are just getting bullied off the ball in a way that you cannot get bullied off the ball if you want to play Ten Hag style of football.
It'd be interesting if Feyenoord's manager comes to Liverpool next season and Ten Hag does keep his job and that old rivalry is renewed again. I'm just worried looking forward because the teams who United are about to play, they're all in the top half of the form table. You know, Crystal Palace away, Brighton away, where Manchester United are worse than horrendous usually. That's like usually the one where you're saving the biggest stink of the season.
Yeah.
Palace is always midweek, takes everyone 7 hours to get to. And then look at the two home games. Arsenal. So fans are going to be going into that thinking, we want Arsenal to win the league, but we know that's not going to quite happen, but we don't want you to win. And then Newcastle, that's looking like a huge game because for the final position, it's going to be six or seven for a team that's at sixes and sevens.
Nice line, Andy. You've been thinking about that one for a while. Just before we move on, actually, two last things to round up quickly if we can. First of all, Carl, the refereeing decisions, literally every single week now we're getting messages about this. Why aren't you talking about the inconsistencies with the decision making with the referees? And to be fair, it hasn't really been much, hasn't really been a big part of our conversations in recent weeks. Should it have been?
Kind of. In that I was always taught never assume malice when incompetence will do. And my opinion on Premier League referees isn't that they've got a secret conspiracy or agenda against Manchester United. It's just that we know quite a few Premier League managers probably aren't good enough to be Premier League managers. And we know there's a dearth of referees. And I think, you know, you want to get referees better, you should start paying referees more. But I don't think people right now have an appetite to pay referees more. There are inconsistencies there, but I don't think it's because referees have it out to get United. Laurie, on his voice notes there, said he thought Garnacho could have had a penalty. What I watched that in real time and I went, Garnacho went off easy. The Antony incident, so Antony's shot bounces off Vitinha's hand. That is as much of a penalty as Aaron Wan-Bissaka's penalty is against Coventry.
Yeah.
I don't think Wan-Bissaka's penalty against Coventry was a penalty. And I don't think, Antony hitting Vitinha's arm is a penalty. I know quite a lot of United fans are saying, well, we want consistency. If it's a penalty there, it's a penalty there. Okay, fine. But also, if you're playing Burnley and your biggest takeaway is complaining about referees, that kind of makes me think that Manchester United didn't do enough playing football. That tends to be my argument, which is Manchester United should be playing better football and not leave things in the hands of referees. That's why I don't have too much of an appetite to discuss refereeing.
That's the core reason why we haven't talked about it more, I think. I think if United's performances had been better and the decisions had cost them and it had been the decisions alone that had cost them, then perhaps it would have been more of a discussion point. Right, last bit. Erik ten Hag said that Manchester United, after the game, are one of the most entertaining, dynamic teams in the Premier League. And you know what? I actually agree.
If you're a neutral.
I actually agree with him.
Yeah.
Well, even to watch in recent weeks. I mean, yeah, okay, you want to win every week, don't you? But in the last 8 games, there's been 38 goals scored in those matches for and against Manchester United. 0 clean sheets for either side. We've had 2-4-3s, 1-win, 1-draw. We've had 1-3-all draw, 1-4-2 win, 2-2-all draws. There's been 1 stoppage time winner at the end of extra time. There's been 1 stoppage time at the end of extra time winner for the opposition ruled out. We've taken the lead once in stoppage time. And then, of course, drew the game. 5 late goals United have conceded in those 8 matches. that have been equalisers for the opposition. Three of those have been in stoppage time, and there's been one stoppage time winner for the opposition as well, and that's in just the last eight games. That is absolutely entertainment, isn't it?
Yeah, it's dynamic because you know it's constantly changing. You're never quite sure what sort of Manchester United team is going to turn up.
I'm not sure it's a good thing overall, no. but I do agree with him.
You've been orange-pilled.
Andy, are you not entertained?
Oh, you are. I mean, neutrals are. I'm also biting my fingernails off because it's not what you want from your team.
No.
I've said it twice now on this podcast and I can't believe it. Endgame Van Gaal, endgame Mourinho. Fans were saying, I'm bored into submission. Mm. Just go for it. Well, this is what it looks like when you just go for it. What it means is you leave massive holes. You concede a lot of goals as well. And it seems ironic saying that this team scores a lot of goals when the goal difference is still, where are we now with it? I know we're moving to one.
Plus one.
Plus one. Plus one. It's all about the result. You know, if that would have been a 1-0 win on Saturday, the tone would have been very different. We would be saying things like, since the turn of the new year, Manchester United have only lost this number of games. It's the results absolutely dominate. And when you don't beat a team like that at home, it's a struggle.
Right, one other thing that seems almost certain now after the draw against Burnley at the weekend is that Manchester United will not be in the Champions League next season. It's mathematically impossible now for them to finish in fourth place, with them being 13 points behind Aston Villa, having played a game more as well. Of course, there is the backdoor way of the coefficient, meaning that fifth place brings a Champions League spot for the Premier League for next year. But that is looking really unlikely now, considering Arsenal, City, Liverpool and West Ham all went out of European competition in the quarterfinals in the last round of matches. So it looks like it's going to be the Europa League or maybe even the Europa Conference League for Manchester United next season. There was an explainer on The Athletic by Ed Mackie last week about who finishes where and who can go into what and what an FA Cup win for City means and what an FA Cup win for Manchester United means. But I thought it was worth just setting out exactly what next season could look like for United, because the schedule is crazy. It's even more crazy than perhaps it's been in recent years for United. So as it stands, sixth place will be enough for a spot in the Europa League if Manchester City win the FA Cup. Of course, United would get in the Europa League no matter where they finish if they win the FA Cup. That's the way to do it. If City win it or United win it, it means that seventh place is likely to be a Europa Conference League spot. United currently lead Newcastle in seventh by 1 point. Of course, they've still got to play them at Old Trafford in a couple of weeks. But the big difference really moving forward is the format change for the competitions. So the group stage, as we know it, and as European competition has had over recent times, is gone. And instead, the format will be one big league. And it's basically a bit like a round robin. So in the Europa League, Manchester United will play 8 group stage games. But they won't be home and away against the same team like we've known in recent years. It will be 8 different teams, 4 of them at home and 4 of them away. In the Europa League, that runs all the way through until January. So there's going to be 2 matches in January in the group stage of the Europa League. The Champions League, similar in that sense as well, but I don't think we need to worry about that. It's complicated enough getting our heads around just this one competition. So basically, what it means is there's 36 teams who are all in one big group. You need to finish in the top 8 of that, so add the most points, one of the top 8 teams having the most points, to get through to the last 16. If you finish between 9th and 16th, you'll be seeded in a playoff to reach the last 16, similar to what we had against Barcelona last season. And if you finish then 17th to 24th, you'll be unseeded in the playoff round to reach the last 16. So basically, if you are one of the top 24 teams in the competition, you do have a chance of going through to the knockout stages. UEFA say it's to add more jeopardy to the competition, ensure there's not dead rubbers at the end of groups and things like that. But it is going to change the schedule a lot, because obviously it means that United still have 6 group phase games before Christmas in the Europa League, but then 2 more in January. That's a big reason why the FA Cup replays have been scrapped, because obviously those two matches being inserted at that time of year is usually where the third and fourth round replays could be played. There's already going to be clashes with the League Cup third round and fifth round with these European ties, which they need to sort out. So that's another issue that they need to contend with. In the Conference League, the format has changed as well to one big group, but there is a difference. If United qualify for the Conference League, they'll have two games at the end of August, which will be to reach the competition proper. So it's the third qualifying round, so they'll play a team home and away, which literally could be anyone, looking at the teams who have been in that competition in recent times. And then they go through to one big group again, but it's only six group phase games, three away, three at home, against six different teams. Same way to qualify for the next round as the Europa League. You finish, you know, in the top eight teams, and then obviously then 9th to 16th and 17th to 24 after that to get into the playoffs. And that's not till the end of February. Crucially for United, if you get in the Conference League, there's no games at the end of January. One other detail, actually, if you're in the Europa League, you can't change your squad for the group phase, despite the fact that two of the matches take place towards the end of January and one is pretty much on the eve of deadline day as well. So if you sell players in January, you won't be able to play them in your final group stage matches. If you sign players in January, you won't be able to play them in your final group stage matches, which just seems like an extra layer of complication. If anyone's still keeping up with that, thank you very much for listening.
Could you just repeat all that, mate?
It's going to be an absolute mare. And we're just saying that as journalists who have to travel and watch these things. I know Laurie's probably listening to this, licking his lips at thinking, ooh, extra trips around Europe. I know Andy's got some stadiums to take off as well. But this is a real big thing. You know, the new system, I think one of the concerning things if you're Manchester United is you are a scalp in the Europa League or in the Conference League. I think it's just being called the Conference League next season. I need to double check that.
Okay, so it's not the Europa Conference League anymore.
They might just be calling it the Conference League next season. I do need to double check that.
Just one more change,
fine,
why not?
Fine. And I know a lot of people always message me going, they need to play the Conference League theme. Europa League and the Conference League, same anthem for now. I don't know if this composer doing anything. So if United get into either one of these competitions, my, you know, doing the back of the sandwich bag maths, United should probably end up in pot one for both of those competitions due to the historical record in the Europa League and the fact that we're in the Champions League group stages this season as well, which means they should, in theory, and I'm pausing and knocking on wood, be aiming for the 1-8 slots in those group stages. So it's one big league format and then everything's split into pots. So you get pot one, pot two, pot three, pot four, and you play one team from each pot at home and one team from each pot away. Boom, boom, boom. So United being in pot one, in theory,
more favourable games.
Yeah. More favourable games in that round robin. However, I mean, we're all saying this. Was any of us expecting to have to learn the intricacies of the Conference League at the start of this season?
No.
No, but here we are.
But here we are.
But here we are. And that's why we're doing it, because my head nearly fell off when I realised quite how different the competition was next season. I knew it was changing, but I didn't know to the extent that it would affect Manchester United's schedule next year. I mean, Andy, it would be eight games for United in the Conference League between the end of August and Christmas, which is a lot to fit in. But it would mean no game at the end of January. So obviously that, you know, avoiding playoffs and whatever else to get through to the knockout stages. So that, in theory, the schedule's maybe slightly kinder if they were in the Conference League. But it's just a nightmare either way. You consider how many games they've had in recent times, how many injuries. This isn't going
to
help.
First of all, they've got to get in the top seven, which is no guarantee. Although the team, teams...
all win the FA Cup.
All losing. Long, long gone are the days when we used to mock Liverpool for playing in the Europa League on a Thursday night, when it just seemed a given that we'd always be in the Champions League. I feel conflicted on it. There's a massive difference between the teams who are playing in Europe and those who are not. Does that work into some sort of advantage? I like European football. I'd rather Manchester United were in the Europa League or even the Conference League than not in it, for many reasons. And I know that some fans have totally different opinions to that. I like watching United play football matches. If there's a game on, that is better than no game being on. I like seeing the world watching the team. There were times with the Champions League where I got a bit bored of the same destinations all the time. And it is much more than the 90 minutes. In recent years, we've been to wonderful cities that traditionally you wouldn't have gone to. Like Bergamo, Atalanta. I think they're still in Europe this season. I think they've done all right. Going to
some English team. I can't remember who.
Going to Kazakhstan. I mean, it was fantastic to go to these places. Clubs want more games. More games equals more money. Demand for tickets is higher than ever. More games means that more fans will actually get an opportunity to watch Manchester United. You might be playing against FC Bag of Spanners from wherever, but it is still a first-team game.
Well, the other thing is your direct debit, if you're opted into the cup scheme for next season, is going to include an automatic one more match. There's going to be four games, definitely. And if you look at the playoffs, there's five games, definitely, to get through to the knockout stages.
Which will annoy some fans, but demand, it is a fact. Demand for tickets is higher than it has ever been. This is one reason we're having the problems with tickets. It's because people are frustrated that they can't get to see games. You go back as recently as Europa League in 16-17, Old Trafford wasn't selling out. It sells out all the time now.
Yeah.
So more games does give more of a chance. I'm not sure it'd be quite so infused if you're asking me this at the start of August and I've got to go to Uzbekistan.
But I think it's also important to know.
But
I know we've had an email question come in saying, would you prefer a season with no Europe, Sir Ten Hag, or another Manchester United manager has more time on the training field? We also have to be very, very aware of the FFP and PSR considerations. United need to be in European competition because they need to convince the bank managers and the accountants that they're earning money. And the best way to earn money at this point in time is to play as many games as possible, to make deep runs into competition. One big reason why, you know, UEFA will tell you it's about creating more jeopardy. It's also to make sure things like United's implosion in the Champions League group stages don't happen anymore. So United, if they do end up in a situation where they win only one of six group games, there is still another chance, a back door for them to remain in European competition. I think it's also important that we mention now, if you get knocked out of the Europa League in the group stages, you're not going into the Conference League. If you get knocked out of the Champions League group stages, you don't get knocked into the Europa League either. Once you're out, you're out. But also, it takes a... Andre Onana will have to have a real disaster class.
And you just reminded me back to this season in Europe. I think the managers feel that more games, while it does bring complications, is better for squad management.
I've never heard a manager say it's a good thing to not be in Europe privately or publicly because of the way it utilises the squad and keeps people involved.
Some of the best atmospheres I've experienced have been in the lesser competitions, going to places like Feyenoord and St Etienne. I've really enjoyed it. You know, if you're on your deathbed, do you regret going to these places? Not at all. I'm glad these events happened. I'm glad that we saw some cracking games as well. We saw some really good visiting supports at Old Trafford. It will be slightly weird, the idea that you don't go home and away, that you can't have a beer with someone and say, well, I'll see you at your place in 2 weeks, because that just doesn't happen.
Well, it's a huge workload for the team as well, isn't it? I mean, the analysts will be having to look at eight teams in the group stage rather than just three. I mean, and the more obscure these teams are, the harder it is to get hold of the data to look at them as well. There's an excitement to that, but it's a lot of work.
There is data now. I mean, you go back decades and there would be no information at all about opponents, especially from the Iron Curtain. You'd literally have Samat Busby getting something like, the centre forward's useful, and going into a game off the back of that. Even in 94, when Man United played Barcelona, I know what scouting level of information was going on. It was Fergie giving his old mate, keep an eye on the winger, he's fast. You know, there was so little. There is loads of statistics. But yeah, the analysts who work their backsides off, you know, they will be coming out of a Wembley, for example. They'll be back on the train to Manchester. They'll be deep into the next opponents. They don't have time to come up for air, even less so next season, looking by the way it's going.
Yeah, it's going to be absolutely crazy. But let's hope Manchester United are in Europe in some form and get the job done, whichever way they can, in the final weeks of this season. Just before we finish the podcast then, a roundup of the women's side as well, Carl, because there's been a good victory and also more good news for the youth setup at United.
Yes, so senior women's team beat Leicester City 1-0 away from home. Ella Toon, 83rd minute in, I'm going to call it a wonder goal.
Yeah.
I was very impressed by it. Mary Earps seemed to be dealing with a little bit of a niggle, but power through as well. So another clean sheet for her. That's fantastic. But also, there's been more success on the women's side with the youth teams. So the under-16s lifted the PGA Cup. They beat Arsenal 3-1 in the final. So that's similar to the FA Youth Cup on the women's side. It's the fourth trophy for Carrington across all levels this season. And yeah, the women's team and the women's academy is going from strength to strength to strength. Things are looking really, really good. It's the FA Cup women's final on the 12th. And that's kicking off 2 o'clock. So 2 hours before the United men's team versus Arsenal as well. So park yourself in front of the TV. Have a good day on the 12th.
What a day that's going to be. Yeah, it's a shame that people can't take in both matches, but I guess this does happen with the scheduling across the men's and women's games from time to time. Congratulations to the women's under-16s for winning that trophy, definitely. Okay, we're going to leave it there. Andy, thank you. Carl, thank you as well. But before we finish off, on Thursday's podcast, we're going to be doing a bit of a squad audit ahead of next season. So Spotify listeners, there will be a poll that you can vote on to decide which area of the pitch needs the most attention for Manchester United this summer. If you've got any thoughts, of course, and you're listening on whatever format, you can get in touch with us, devilspod@theathletic.com. Also send us a message on any of our social media as well if you want to get involved in that debate for Thursday. But for now, thank you for listening, and we'll see you on the next one. Take care, bye-bye.
The Athletic.